Welcome to another edition of Simons Says, a podcast devoted to conversationalists and the curious-minded. Here's your host, me, the follically challenged Dave Simons, certified financial planner and all-around nice guy.
Hi, everyone. So I'm wondering how many of you might have seen this movie. Now, I'm going to date myself because it goes back a little bit, but it is a psychological thriller that came out way back in 1978. It was an all-star cast, by the way. It had Anthony Hopkins in it, Anne Margaret, Burgess Meredith, and it was called Magic. Some of you might have seen that. It came out in 78. I saw it for the first time, and I remember it very well, as you'll learn why I say that here in a second, on a particular Sunday night in January of 1981. So a couple of years after it came out in the theaters, it's now on television. And I had just gone back to Mizzou into my dorm after the Christmas break. My roommate had yet to arrive, so I'm by myself, and I'm flipping through a few channels. And by the way, for you youngins out there, yeah, we only had a few channels back then to choose from. So there's this movie, Magic. And I thought, oh, I've heard of this before. I think it's some kind of like psychological thriller. So I sat down and I started watching it. Oh, boy. I don't know if you can tell, but my eyes like are really wide open here. Anthony Hopkins was a magician turned ventriloquist. One thing that you learned over the course of this movie is he had some serious psychological issues. And over time, he started to take on the personality of his puppet. Or was it the other way around? Was the puppet sort of coming to life and taking on the personality of Anthony Hopkins? I mean, mind-blowing, right? And I know, and I can almost feel even now, it's palpable, my heart starting to race just thinking about that movie.
You do magic too?
Corky does magic. I only do tricks.
There's never been a magician like him. How long you been like this, kid?
Now, you have to remember, I'm 18 years old at the time, and I've always had a very active mind, very active brain, and it just goes in a lot of different ways. Well, as you might imagine, it was like fireworks watching this movie as I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what if that happened to me? That started to come to my mind, and blood pressure starts to go up a little bit. Could I go insane? Oh my gosh, could I? What if I'm possessed? Is he possessed? Is the puppet somehow supernaturally possessing Anthony Hopkins? Could some kind of evil spirit possess me? And I mean, folks, something bad was about to happen that I could not hardly even articulate to you today. And we're going to get into this, but little did I know at the time that I had a genetic predisposition to this anxiety and even some panic attack disorder. I didn't know it at the time. I had never experienced it, but it was the right place at the right time, or can we say the wrong place at the wrong time, however you want to articulate that. But with that, and then my brain going off in a million different areas, watching this kind of scary movie, just like that. It's hard for me to describe. I would later learn that there's something called detachment syndrome, but I felt in a weird way like I wasn't even myself. I had detached. I wasn't like physically outside of my body. That's not what I'm talking about, but I didn't feel that I was in my body, if that makes sense. I didn't feel like I was connected to myself as all these wild, scary thoughts, and I was in full-blown fear-induced panic, and I now was convinced I am Anthony Hopkins. I'm that person, and I'm going to go downhill. I'm 18. My life is over. I'm going to be institutionalized. I'm going to be schizophrenic. I'm not kidding. All of this happening in nanoseconds. I turned the TV off. I had never experienced anything like this in my life. I couldn't describe it. I didn't have the age, experience, or skill to understand what was happening. I still remember, even though it was, 42 and a half years ago, like it was yesterday, because I remember leaving my dorm room and walking down the hallway, and now my hands are like this, And I leaned down to get a drink of the fountain at the end of the hallway at the dorm room. And I remember thinking, what is going on with me? What is going on with me? I'm going crazy. I'm Anthony Hopkins. An evil spirit has taken over me. And I'm walking down to the dorm room. I have my eyes down and I'm sitting there. And I don't really remember anything after that. I don't remember my roommate coming home. What happened there, as I kind of wrap up this personal story, was I don't want to overstate this. I really don't. I don't want to be dramatic, but there was a little bit of a deterioration in the peace that I'd always felt in life. There just was. And one thing you have to know about panic attack disorder is once it happens, if it's a true panic attack, especially if there's a genetic component to it, it's probably not your last one. So I would have one in my classroom and I would be sitting there in class and everything was going fine, right? I'm taking notes, I'm listening to the professor, and all of a sudden this thought, what if you turn into Anthony Hopkins? What? Why did I just think that? The rest of the class was survival time. I couldn't focus on anything that the professor said. All I know is there's the door and I got to get to it. But if I do that, everyone's going to see me, laugh at me. I'll be embarrassed. What if I fall down? What if I foam at the mouth? What if I start salivating? What if I have Tourette's syndrome and I start cussing at everybody? Then I'll be institutionalized. You see what happens here? It just builds and builds and builds and builds. And folks, I lived a private hell for a long time. I didn't tell anybody, but my world kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller. By the time I was a senior in college, this is absolutely 100% true, my first semester, my senior year, I had skipped 45 classes. I don't know how I graduated. I'm thankful I didn't go into the sciences or math or anything like that, and I was just a journalism major. I don't mean to degrade that because we still had to study, but let's just say if you're going to skip classes, skipping some classes related to journalism, I could get by on that. So I was able to survive that, still not talking to anybody about it. My family didn't know. I wasn't close to my family at the time anyway, and I lived this private hell for the longest time. So I know a lot of you who know me, this is a real shock, and you're sitting there going, what in the world? I'm going public with this for the first time, and the reason, after all these years, is because I know some people watching right now are going, oh my gosh, this is me now. And how are you today? Well, I'm great today, all right? Let me tell you. And we're going to get into this when I introduce my guest here in a second, but I was able to overcome it. Part of it, a lot of it, most of it, counseling, but a lot of it too, I got to be honest, is just age and experience and tinkering with things that help. And there's kind of a goofy thing that I implemented years ago that really helped. I am here at age almost 61. I haven't had any kind of major panic attack since I was in my 40s. But you feel the rumbling there if it's a genetic thing, but you just learn the skill set and you learn to overcome it and you learn to not empower it. And that's part of what we're going to talk about today. So without further ado, man, we're going to dig into this a little bit because it's such a prevalent topic. And I'm not an expert in it. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a licensed counselor, but I do have the person who fits all of those, including a PhD, a couple of PhDs, someone who's wicked smart here. J.J. Meyer, who works here in the St. Louis area at Insight Counseling, she has not only a PhD in counseling, which is great, but she also used to be in the biochemistry field. So she also kind of looks at potentially how the body responds and how the brain reacts to all this. So I can't think of a better expert to bring in to talk about this. So without further ado, my guest today on the Simon Says podcast, J.J. Meyer. Welcome, J.J.
Thank you so much.
So what do you do with all that? I just threw it all out there. Have fun. I want a free counseling session here
now.
Absolutely.
Well,
what I just described can't be a huge shock or surprise to you because you've heard these stories, right? Mm-hmm. When someone comes in and just unloads all of something like that for the first time, What do you typically do? I assume you sit back, you listen, you write notes. How does that work the first time somebody comes in and says, I'm a mess, listen to my story?
What I do personally, the first session is I'm trying to conceptualize clients. So conceptualization means trying to figure out what's going on underneath all of the story. So I'm trying to kind of make sense. So I would ask a lot of questions. It could be from current to all the way back to childhood. Also including family histories and, you know, parents, their mental health, sibling, cousins. Not so much cousins, more like a, you know, direct relatives.
Immediate family.
More so, immediate families. Just so that I can get a picture of what, and also like the environment that's growing up is very important. So I'm trying to figure out kind of in my own head is, being a biochemist, as you said, I'm looking at the genetic by environment interaction. Typically, how we present ourselves is a combination of both. It's genetic and environment. So, for example, if somebody comes in and tells me the story and also say my mother has anxiety, my dad has, you know, depression, my sibling. So I would know there are some kind of genetic components to it. If somebody comes in and is like, you know, nothing. Everybody is healthy as can be. And however, this thing happened when I was, just say, 10. I was bullied. Then I would know it's more like trauma related. You know, it's more of an environment.
Is that like a PTSD kind of thing? Is that what you're referring to?
It can be. Yeah. It can be. If somebody got bullied, it can be PTSD related. But the point is, I'm trying to figure out what's the contribution of the presenting issue. And if it's genetic, typically, I mean, there's never a clear cut, so that I just want to make sure. We just want to know whether there is a contribution.
Yeah, because it could take a while. You're not going to have all the answers after the first session.
Right.
So as you're working with somebody through this, it sounds like what you're describing here is kind of a nature versus nurture. That's what everyone talks about. So do you find that they're typically, in most severe cases, that there is a nature and a nurture, or there is something genetic plus something that happened to them, or not necessarily. Perhaps the trauma was so bad. There was, and I hate to be too dramatic here, but constant sexual abuse when you're a little kid, it can just set you off on a really bad path. Or do you find in most cases, well, it doesn't have to be that drastic. It is like in my case, there's a bit of a genetic component plus some other things that are happening in your life, which I really didn't describe, but you bring those things together and now you've got an explosion. What do you typically see in most cases for people who have really bad panic attack, general anxiety disorders?
Panic attack, what you describe particularly, there's two categories. One is called unexpected. One is expected. Unexpected is just like nothing traumatic happened to me, but I just had all of a sudden this panic attack. So it's unexpected. Mm-hmm. Typically, unexpected panic attacks are more genetic related, typically. And expected is more described frequently, more associated with traumatic experiences. So if they were, I just say, bully again. So if somebody in the class are just like, you know, huffing and puffing, the person tend to get triggered. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of expected. You can kind of trace, say, yeah, this person was bullied, therefore it's expected panic attack. So it's like, again, based on what your question is, like, it's typically a combination of both.
Yeah, that's what I would have assumed.
Yeah.
So let's go back now in your own life and career, because I think we need to set the stage as we come back and go deeper into some of this. So you didn't start off saying, I'm going to be a counselor.
No.
Tell me about what you started off in biochemistry. And I think you were at Monsanto for quite some time, turned Bayer. But tell me a little bit about the beginning stages for you.
So I came from Taiwan. I grew up in Taiwan. Came here after college, went to Virginia Tech, and my background is science. Mm-hmm. And so during that time when I was at Virginia Tech, I was a food science and nutrition major, actually master's degree. Only dissertation left. I'm almost finished that master, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. I work at a biochemistry lab. For kind of part-time, we're allowed to work up to 20 hours. And so when I was working in the lab, the principal investigator, so the professor, PI, asked me whether I want to be as a PhD candidate in biochemistry. I was like, no. I was only getting my master's degree in food science and nutrition and, you know, go off with my life. He said, what are you going to do with food science and nutrition? I have no idea, but I just want to get a degree and move on.
Yeah, get out, right.
But anyway, he just really encouraged me. He actually filled out my application form. He said, I really think you need to consider this. So long story short, I said yes, and full ride scholarship and everything. And so got the degree, came to St. Louis for my daughter, actually. She is hearing impaired. Hmm. And we got her into Central Institute for the Deaf. That was actually the main reason we're in St. Louis.
Okay.
And as I moved to St. Louis, did postdoc, 2 years postdoc at, a 4-year postdoc at WashU, and then went to Monsanto, or there, 21 years. I guess the last 7 years of my career there, I just had this high degree of dissatisfaction. Mm. I think mostly from life experience, I guess. Growing up, I was bullied a lot.
Back in Taiwan?
Yes.
Okay.
Mostly by my sister.
Oh.
Yeah. And I'm the youngest, and we came from a relatively dysfunctional family, mm-hmm. and really no parental supervision. And so my sister can just do whatever she wants with me.
Do you have a relationship with her today?
No.
Okay.
Healthy boundary.
Got it.
So I've been always struggling with my own mental health and just dissatisfaction, depression, anxiety, you name it, I got it. And so I've been in counseling since I was in the 30s, kind of all the way. And when I was, it was when I was 50, I just like, I need to rethink about what I want the rest of my life to look like. Mm-hmm. I know biochemistry is not it. Continue to work at Monsanto is not what it is. So I got counseling. And actually my counselor said, you should consider to be a counselor.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was like, interestingly, both of my careers, somebody suggested to me.
It's like they're saying, you're in the wrong seat. You need to come over here.
Probably.
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, I'll see. So I started my master's degree while I was still working at Monsanto. And after the first semester, I know it was the right thing. So I submitted my resignation. I was like, see ya. I'm going to do this. And here I am.
So this is fascinating to me. So your entire background, which is in biochemistry, has that come in helpful for you in your newfound profession?
Absolutely. I think it's not just about biochemistry, because I have done 2 years of postdoc in the neurobiology department. So I have some neurobiology background. Mm-hmm. So that first of all, help me with counseling, because in counseling, you learn theory, but I always want to figure out how did it work neurologically, particularly with trauma. And that's kind of the area I'm specializing, grief and trauma, has a lot of neuroscience background behind it. And so it helped me to kind of get a grasp of having the background to help me like really sink my teeth into the biochemistry, what kind of treatment methodology make more sense to a biochemist, mm-hmm. right? I need to have that background, a biological background, for me to feel like, ah, I'm buying into this. And so that's one aspect. The other aspect is really being a researcher. And I think once you are a PhD, you never give up being a researcher. I research methodology a lot on my own, but it just kind of, I just have all these questions. How did it work? People said this methodology worked. How did it work? How did it help you from a, you know, emotional brain versus cognitive brain? What part does it impact? How does it make your nervous system more calm? I always want to understand those kind of the background mechanism.
Let me interject there, because that's really important, I think. When you heard my story at the beginning,
uh-huh.
and we talked before this, so you already knew, this was nothing a surprise when JJ heard me talking about this. But when I talked about the fact that it was palpable what was happening, so it starts off as thoughts. I'm watching a movie.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's a scary movie. Anyone's heart rates might going to go up a little bit. That's yeah. normal. But what was starting to happen, let's say, in my brain and what the signals were sending when the thoughts were coming, oh my gosh, am I going to go crazy? And then that trigger, whatever that was, that I don't know what is going on in my brain and my body, but can you, in a general sense, explain to me what in the world is going on in the various parts of my brain and body at that time?
What a great question. Mm. So it's similar to when a person that has PTSD got triggered. You're triggered. That means it activates your limbic system. So it's our, we call it lizard brain. It's like an animal brain. Well, lizard brain, mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm.
So animal brain, when you like scare a lizard, they jump, then they strike,
yep,
they right. run away. That's an immediate reaction, and we are animal. So that part of us never really changed, such as if you see a snake, you just jump, you don't really think. That's a part of a brain that keep our animal survival mechanism alive and well.
Yeah, it's to survive, that's right.
Right, to survive. And that's why we call it a lizard brain. It's scientific term. It's called a limbic system. What it does is that you got triggered, and then your limbic system activates your peripheral nervous system. So your heart starts pumping. You start getting hot. You getting ready to like either fight or flight. That all connected. It starts from receiving the signal to whole body engagement. So you basically, what you're describing is that once you got triggered, that activate the entire survival mechanism for you. That's why the heart going and just like, oh my God, what's going on? I need to either fight or flight. You're looking for doors.
Yep, right.
Your flight.
And right? It's a feedback loop in a way, because as back in the day when this happened very frequently, so it might start here with a trigger, the body would respond, fight yes. or flight, but then the brain would say, oh, your heart rate is going up, something is wrong, and mm-hmm. they it was almost like the yeah. two would battle for each other and keep getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. You are actually, the feedback is actually feeding right back into the limbic system. Is activating. It's like, run faster. Wow. What? How come you're not running? Run faster. Get going, right? Is that system. What we did not talk about is your wizard brain, which is your cognitive brain. When your limbic system is activated, it shut down your rational brain. Hmm. And that's what it is. When this is going fight or flight, you're not thinking, maybe I need to calm down. This is really nothing. I need to pay attention to the class. No, this part of it, this is, again, it's survival. You don't want to think when you're surviving.
That's true.
You need to run.
Boy, I hate to think that, though. This is new to me. It's the wizard brain. I wish that had more power. I could have used the wizard brain to beat up the lizard brain back when I was a young person.
It's hard. This is hardwired in your biology. So you, when it comes to survival, your lizard brain always take over.
Oh, man.
So it's hard. That's why when people get into like panic attack, it's very hard to like think your way out of it because your whole body is engaging very primal animal survival instinct. This part of brain just done.
Well, so over the years, as I would tell my story, a lot of times people would say, oh, well, you're a rational, logical, smart guy. Why can't you just say, well, this is stupid. You're not going crazy. And I didn't have an answer. I'd say, I know. Here in my lucid moments, I can say that.
Exactly.
But when you're in the middle of these supernatural thoughts that I'm a schizophrenic, oh my gosh, I'm going to be institutionalized, I'm going to have Tourette's, I'm going to be possessed. Hello, logic brain, it's gone.
No, it just shut down. Like so many studies out there, it's just not even a competition. Hmm. Yeah.
Man, oh man. So on the genetic side, we've talked a little bit about that. As I, to add a little bit more to my personal story, and I told JJ mm-hmm. this before, I also come from a dysfunctional family, and I did not know my real biological dad. Mm. So the first counselor I had asked me about genetics. Does anyone else in your family have this? And I said, no, not that I know. Now, I've kept it secret from them. Maybe somebody's kept it secret from me. I don't know, but not that I'm aware. What about your dad? I don't know my dad. Oh, is there any way to find out? I'm pretty sure he's alive. So, long story short, I actually found my grandpa, my real dad's dad, and struck up a conversation with him. And JJ, you talk about my whole world. I don't know if I'd say it became illuminated or crashed in on me. But I found out that my own dad had the worst of the worst issues with agoraphobia, where he couldn't even leave his house to even go get the mail from his mailbox. Mm-hmm. Because what happens, and you know this well, but when you have the worst of the worst panic attack disorder, your world does become smaller because, I just had a panic attack in the movie theater. I can't go there again. Mm-hmm. I just had one in the supermarket. Ooh, that's a scary place. Mm-hmm. And then as you have more and more panic attacks and you just keep coming into the comfort of your own little world, that's why I skipped 45 classes in one semester because I kept having these panic attacks around. So now I find out that there's a genetic component. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it made it worse when I found out that he had been institutionalized, that he had suffered, that he, and even more so, I'm not going to describe here, but it is so off the rails of things that were happening in his life. I will tell you, I did meet him later, and it would be like you and me talking right now. He's as normal as the day is long, which in a way made it scarier again. It's like, oh my gosh, I wanted to see a crazy guy because I could then justify and say, well, I know I'm not him. But I couldn't say that. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I found out genetic, plus I had been bullied, plus I was the smallest kid in my class. Mm. I entered high school at 4'11 and 95 pounds. Mm. So the bullying kept. So I was the perfect recipe for all of this to occur. Genetics, some trauma growing up, being picked on and all that stuff. And no wonder it it happened to me. So take that and let's dig into the genetic component a little bit. Mm-hmm. Is there something that science has found in the brain that says, oh, you could be more susceptible to general anxiety or panic attacks? Or has science been able to zone in on that?
Not yet. I think most of the study regarding anxiety, so we're talking about not just panic attack, but all type of anxiety disorder, I just say, general anxiety disorder, social anxiety, OCD, you know, there's a whole slew of anxiety disorder. In general, people started using the fMRI, so imaging study. So imaging study, as you know, can only see structural, like anatomical structural differences. It cannot see at the molecular level, right? So such as, oh, you have more serotonin or you have more of XYZ. It's hard to do that kind of study when a person is still alive and even when they're dead. So with fMRI, I think the most of the study is that there's some either larger amygdala, which is a kind of, they call it, is the alarm system. That is a trigger, where trigger typically happens. So when something happens, you hear the sound, you see the image, or you sense something, and that goes into amygdala. And your amygdala basically is our alarm system. And people that have anxiety disorder typically has overactive amygdala. So when amygdala got activated, it's connected into kind of your memory network, hippocampus, and then that also go down to your peripheral nervous system. So that's probably the extent people know your amygdala. Science figure out your amygdala is overactive. Mm-hmm. And that's about it, not so much more.
Is that connected to also people with depression? Because from what I understand, anxiety and depression are siblings in a way. I'm fortunate I never had an issue with depression, but isn't it somewhat common that people can have both, that there is some connection to the two?
Okay, so from the perspective of anxiety and depression, how our natural, again, we're talking about survival mechanism, right? So if you have, for example, I'm going to use a kind of roundabout way to talk about this. This is not as straightforward as most people think. So if you are a baby, for example, if you cry and cry and cry, and mom kind of is like, stop, 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 like mom is anxious, baby will be anxious. So your reactionary style will be anxiety. When somebody's left the room, you'll be like anxious, right? So that's one type of response. The other type of response, baby cry, 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 and nobody came. And cry, 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 nobody came. So what happened? Baby just shut up because they're tired. They fell asleep or whatever. So finally somebody came, the baby would develop this habit, not habit, habit. Develop this response is that, okay, now you can. I don't even want to talk to you. Mm. It's called avoidance. Mm. When we have, and these are different attachment styles, depends on how, when your upbringing, how you were cultivated, whether you are attended to, but very anxiously attended to, or not get attended to. When you're not getting attended to, typically you get to a place more of a shutdown, because when I cry, nobody came. So if you look at from a trauma perspective, if a person at the bottom is just like, we're pretty happy. If you got triggered, typically you go to the anxiety. When you get too much anxiety, just like the baby, they go into shutdown. Mm. So shutdown is a reaction to too much of a stimulation.
Okay.
And so, because nobody came, nobody care, you just shut down. That's what we call anxiety. What happens is, so when you're calm, you're anxious, you shut down. Coming out of anxiety, you need to go through anxiety. Coming out of depression, you need to go through anxiety again.
Oh, back on the way down, right.
To become calm. So when people are like coming out of depression, it's like, I'm getting so anxious. I don't know how to deal with this. I'm going to go back to anxiety because I go back to depression because then they don't have to deal with their own anxiety.
Wow, who thought that depression could actually be someone's safe place? But that's kind of what you're describing.
It is. When you shut down, you don't deal with all of these trigger, right? That's why when somebody say, I'm depressed, they just go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
They sleep a lot, like no energy. Oh, yeah, sun comes up. Oh, whatever. I'm going to go to sleep. So you don't deal with the anxiety because when you actually come out of depression, what you're faced with is anxiety.
So, man, this is very, very enlightening to me. All those years when I had the worst of the worst, and I told you this before, we talk about fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where this came from. I don't know it's because growing up with my own trauma and being bullied that I vowed I will not let that ever happen to me again.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would do is I would battle through the worst of the worst panic attacks. Mm-hmm. And I would, at Mizzou, if I was having one in college, I would literally tightly grip my desk and I would get through it and I would battle through it. Now, maybe if I had that same class 2 days later, I might skip that, but I would never allow it to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, I don't care if you pass out walking to your class. I don't care. You are getting your clothes on,
mm-hmm.
and you are walking to that class,
mm-hmm.
and you are going to sit in there, and you're going to do it. I don't care that you just had a major panic attack on the airplane last time. You can't avoid the rest of your life getting on that airplane. So you get your sorry butt on that airplane, and you have the worst panic attack if you have to.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have to do an emergency landing because they have some crazy guy on there who's like trying to open up the hatch,
mm-hmm.
then that's just what's going to have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
As I've done a lot of studying of this, I feel very blessed I have that. Because so many people who have panic attack disorder, like as bad as I had it, don't have that skill.
Yeah.
And they just don't feel it's worth it. And so their world does become smaller and smaller. And they never quite have the joyous life that I've learned to have from that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have an answer of that, this, but how... what separates people like me who decided I'm going to go to the mat on this, even if it does drive me crazy, versus someone who says, I can't do that? And one more thought on that. When I met my real dad, we had a discussion about this. And I asked him, I said, what would happen to you if you walked out of your house to get the mail? I couldn't do that. Why not? Oh, I could. He didn't really have an answer. And I said, why don't you just, when you're having that, get on your shoes, walk out and say, I don't care what happens to me, I'm doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told him that, he was jealous, he was envious that I was able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any idea what causes people to be separated in that way?
This is coming from kind of my personal either practice or experience. I can't say this is like scientifically mm-hmm. validated. Mm-hmm.
Your experience is good enough. It really is.
So I two things. One is what I want to say is what you are doing to yourself, such as, I don't care if I pass out, I'm going to go. Actually, what you're doing is one kind of therapeutic approach is called exposure. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what you're doing, right? So if I'm afraid, I'm just going to just charging forward. I'm going to face my fear. I'm going to punch fear in the nose. That is exposure. And typically, you step into the fear, it doesn't really sustain. Fear is just a feeling. Typically, once you step into it, it just kind of dissipates. And actually, there's another therapeutic methodology called somatic psychotherapy. It's also when you become anxious, you lean into it, you feel it, you go in and just stay with it. And that's really the easiest way to interact with anxiety versus trying to avoid, trying to organize our life to avoid it. It's actually prolong
absolutely. The
process. So number one, you did a great job. You figured that part out.
Gold star. Thank you.
Yeah. That's one. Second thing is resilience. There are some studies on resilience that they found that to be partly genetically kind of ingrained also. So for me, so I remember I have another sister. She said, my parents should be so happy that none of us ended up to be homeless or, you know, because of our family environment. I, from very, very young age, I always felt like life could have been better than this. I don't know where that's coming from. That's why it's kind of keep me always on the searching path to find a better way to live, better way to structure my own better way to grow. I don't know where that is coming from, but I think my mom kind of has that. She has a tough life, but she's kind of keep charging forward. So I'm thinking that's probably part of the resilience. That's probably where that came from, because I always know life can be better.
You know, I think, see if this makes sense to you. I think part of me being bullied when I was younger actually helped in some way on this subject we're talking about, because I would get punched in the face on the bus. Mm. True story, it would happen. I would do nothing about it. And all the other kids would laugh. And I would feel terrible about myself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I became a bit of a loner growing up, elementary school through high school. And I spent a lot of time by myself in my room. Mm-hmm. And I would read all the time, and I got that. I think that's one reason I have a curious mind, is because even back then I was constantly reading and trying to figure things out. But there was this lack of self-worth that I felt, and it was deep. Mm-hmm. You're no good. Mm-hmm. You stop growing, so you can't be on sports teams anymore. Your family doesn't love you. You're all this horrible, negative self-talk. Mm-hmm. As I got older, there was something in me that vowed, you're never going to allow yourself to feel that way again. You know, you grew up to be this 5'10", 175 pound. I think that's frankly one of the reasons I became an athlete and a triathlon guy and qualified for the Boston Marathon. I think part of it isn't necessarily done for healthy reasons up here, because it was like, hey, world, I'm worthy. Mm-hmm. Look at me. I'm accomplishing all of these things. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I think a lot of the negative stuff that was happening to me growing up, when I started to have these horrible panic attacks later, I said, I will not let this thing bully me. Yeah. Nobody's going to bully me. This thought isn't going to bully me.
Yeah.
Now,
oh, good.
The negative side of that, even to this day, as I am into my 60s, here's the unhealthy part of it. I have gotten myself into some bad situations when I see something being bullied, someone being bullied, yeah. I step in.
Right, right.
And I say, not on my watch.
Right.
I had an incident at the Midway Airport in Chicago, and my wife was there, and she watched it. She gets it because she knows me. But I saw a guy bullying someone, and I got up, and I went over there, and I was about to get physical against this bully because I said, not on my watch.
Right.
I've watched this happen to me personally.
Right.
So that's the weird conundrum here, I think, that happens is you had all these negative things. Now you're having another negative thing, and it's not going to take me down. I really think if I had never been bullied or if I had more of a normal upbringing, maybe I wouldn't have fought it so hard. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. That's you're describing a phenomenon called post-traumatic growth. So people have done this study with orphans that were roaming the street, kids roaming the street homeless. And they've been through a lot of traumatic events, but they organize themselves. They take care of each other. You thinking kids that have been, you know, often at very young age and live on the street will have such a traumatic experience. But just this group of kids, they don't. They actually develop these you know, just whole different sets of skills.
Survival skills,
yeah.
Right?
And we call it post-traumatic growth, which is not as popular. I mean, people don't talk about it too much, but it's like almost the opposite of post-traumatic stress. This is post-traumatic growth.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah. And so certain people, and they that's what they're studying. These is like, how come same experience, same group, a group of kids experience the same thing? Certain people develop PTSD, certain people develop post-traumatic growth. And they think that's probably more genetic because they don't know how it happens. They just know not everybody experiencing the same thing would have the same kind of presentation. And that's what kind of come back to this thing about genetic by environment. Bad environment itself does not necessarily make you a trauma victim. Some environment actually make you tougher. And actually that's what kind of my narrative as well, is that I so appreciate where I am because of what I have experienced.
I get it.
And if I don't have that experience, I just like, yeah, whatever, you know, just take it easy. I don't have to work so hard. I don't have to keep learning, keep growing. It's life is just easy. So I do think there is some connection because of what happened. And then you kind of develop all these separate skill sets that you don't intend to develop if otherwise.
Yeah, I hate to even admit it, frankly, because I don't like to look back and say, well, if I didn't have all those things, I wouldn't have the success I have today. No, I don't want to say that. Yeah. I don't want to say that was such a wonderful thing growing up, which I'm not even getting into a lot of the really bad stuff that I went through growing up. But there was a lot of the trauma, honestly, made me the successful person that I am today.
Yes.
And I hate to admit that because there are plenty of successful people who had an idyllic childhood.
Right.
Leave it to Beaver childhood. So
it's
so weird how life works, as you know, that different backgrounds. But I want to turn our attention now to people watching this who are saying, oh my gosh, they're talking about me. I'm suffering from this. I'm a 25-year-old. I'm a 45-year-old. Or, oh my gosh, my sister needs to see this podcast because she's really struggling with this. Be as general or specific as you want, but I think it's important that we help people watching this. What would you advise those people to do first if they've never really talked to someone? I assume it's to go seek counseling.
Yeah.
Tackle that. Plus, are you in favor in appropriate circumstances of prescription drugs temporarily, or do you avoid that? Just explore that.
Personally, and again, this is coming from being a biochemist, if you are genetically predisposed, I personally think medication would help. We can't really pull it so like, okay, this is genetic, this part is genetic.
Yeah, right.
But if you know there's a genetic predisposition, that means your brain chemistry is not in balance. Medication can definitely help. If a person just have no trace of genetic histories of any anxiety or panic attack, but just has a lot of trauma, psychotherapy. In general, that's kind of how I look at it. Most people have both, right? So that's why most people recommend medication plus psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. Particularly like somebody like OCD. There's definitely a genetic component to it. The best treatment is medication plus psychotherapy. But if you say, I'm so totally against medication, although I have family history, it's fine. We can do psychotherapy, help you manage it. But so that you know, your bar will be much higher because you're fighting against your genetic as well. So in general, if people are not too objective to taking medication, I would say both tend to work the best.
I can say personally, that's what I did. I mean, I was on some medication for a number of years. I never wanted to make it a lifetime thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to extract myself off that. But I'm a big proponent of it, especially if your licensed counselor recommends something like that. Okay, so this person is in counseling. They're going through it. Maybe or maybe not. They are on some sort of medication, whether it's very mm-hmm. temporary or goes on mm-hmm. for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What's some other advice that you might give to somebody watching this to help them through this really tough time?
Okay. So if we're talking about psychotherapy, there are certain type of psychotherapy definitely works better than others. Because earlier we talked about survival mechanism, right? So I want to make a distinction here. Talk therapy engage your cognitive brain. So which is your thinking part, like, what do you think? I'm thinking X, Y, Z. When you talk, you're engaging your prefrontal cortex, your cognitive brain. Trauma and survival, as we talk about, sits in limbic system. So how do we use this to control that one? As we just talked about, this is not very effective. So the type of therapy that engage in your limbic system, such as somatic approach, we talk about exposure. Exposure is right now under behavioral therapy, right? So, but it's really not about talking. You just do. You just go interact with your own limbic system, basically just walk into the fear, right? So that works well. Somatic works well because somatic is about calming our body. Remember when the limbic system got triggered, your body have all these reaction. So somatic calmed your body. It's called bottom up approach. Calming your body, and that's basically it's a dialogue with your nervous system and say, it's okay. Let's just make the body calm first, and your nervous system will receive the message that the environment is safe. So calming your body, that's what we call it bottom-up approach. The other one, which I use, I'm a certified EMDR therapist. I use a lot is EMDR therapy. EMDR is a kind of a go-to for trauma therapy. It basically taps into your memory network and bring your I personally call it it's a subconscious process. When we're doing EMDR, we don't talk. We're just in our own processing. Mm. And it's really interacting with your experience, your memory network, interacting with your limbic system to allow you to process the past memory and allow kind of software update.
What does that acronym stand for, by the way?
EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Eye movement, okay.
And it's mimicking REM sleep, right? So during the day, we got a lot happening. How your memory got integrated into long-term memory is during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. So when we're deep sleeping, REM sleep, that's where what's happening during the day got integrated into long-term memory. That's where your bullying experience got integrated into your long-term memory. So when it got integrated, you saw a bully, you get triggered. And then you got like starting to either fight or flight. That whole memory got integrated into your long-term memory. So within EMDR, we're mimicking that eye movement to retrieve that past memory, specific past memory, and allow your cognitive brain to interact with that long-term memory to kind of bring it up to date. And that's what the process of EMDR is, using this eye movement to interact.
So this isn't a hypnotized thing. So you're conscious. So tell me the process. You're sitting in a room, and what are you doing? If you're not talking, what are you doing to bring up this rapid eye movement?
So you have a light bar, and then your eye will go with the bar. So your eye will do this, and I'm mimicking the REM sleep. But before that, you will be set up with a specific what you want to process, right? So you would have we would ask you about what image that you remember as early as possible, such as 10th grade or 9th grade on school bus. So there's an image. What feeling do you have? You know, fear, maybe. What do you say to yourself? We call it negative cognition. It's like, I am worthless, or I don't belong, whatever you say to yourself. And then what's your body sensation? Like tied up, right? So all of that comes into play during the setup phase. So almost I have you step closer to the experience. If you're so far away, we can't do much about this experience. So we want to get it close enough so you're like almost there. And then with trigger, we get you to do eye movement so that you can interact with that experience. And a lot of time, clients' emotion goes up. They're like actually experience that moment. They start crying. And after a while, this is the foundation of EMDR. We call it AIP, Adaptive Information Processing. During that REM sleep and that activation phase, we have human body and brain is part of the body, has a natural tendency to heal itself. Mm-hmm. If you provide the safe environment. Therefore, when you're processing, you're in the fear, but there's also outside, that's why you're awake. It's like, it's okay, it's safe here. You're integrating this past and current experience together. That was able to remold this past experience to make it a safer experience. So at the end, so you will get triggered. At the end of processing, people tend to become really, really calm. And then after that, of course, you need to process it until the person is no longer triggered. you can keep revisiting the same target again and again until a person is just like, there's nothing. I'm just not getting triggered. And clients typically say after those processing once is complete, they see the same situation, they don't get triggered. Well, let me rephrase that. They don't get triggered. There's a concept called window of tolerance, right? They don't get triggered outside of window of tolerance. That means, oh, I gotta run. You will still get triggered when you see somebody's bullying somebody. You will still like angry. But you're within your window of tolerance. That means you're like, I'm really pissed. But your cognitive brain is still fully in control. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. You're within window of tolerance. The key is when you feel like running, you're outside of window of tolerance. When you feel like I am upset, but my cognitive brain is still stronger than my
control, right.
Limbic system, mm-hmm. you're within window of tolerance. Because we don't want a person like when see somebody get bullied, it's just like, yeah, there's nothing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You will still get aggravated,
right.
But you're within window of tolerance. It's like, I probably should not go up there and punch the person.
But I can at least be present there.
Exactly.
To say, I'm watching this.
Exactly. It's like, hey, I'm watching you. And yeah, that's the difference. When you, before EMDR, you're outside. After EMDR, you're inside.
I think what people need to understand who might be in the middle of this and are very intrigued by what you're saying is, we are not talking about the fact that you might have had this lifelong trauma or you've been suffering from panic attacks for a long time, that all of a sudden you get proper counseling, you do what's needed to be done, and you feel much better. That's great. But the original triggers never just disappear and like, oh, I don't even remember having a panic attack ever. I don't even, you mean I was bullied when I was a kid? Oh, I didn't know that.
Right.
That stuff. Don't think that somehow magically that will just go away. So again,
correct.
Using my personal experience, I did something very goofy to help me finally overcome this.
Mm-hmm.
And once I was going through proper therapy and all that, so I'm in my 40s now at this time, and I don't know where this came from, but I just decided one time when I felt, again, it's always going to be there because I personally right. have the genetic component that's there, and you start to feel the rumblings like, uh-huh. I feel a little unsettled right now.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure why. Maybe something triggered me out.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to try to name it. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel it. So what I did, I don't know where this came from, but one day I said, oh, hello, thought. You know, I'm kind of busy right now. So here's the deal. Make yourself at home. Come on into my brain. The refrigerator stocked. If you need to have a beer, you want something to eat, but I'm kind of busy. And so I'm talking to whatever this nebulous, fearful, scary thing is that has really been debilitating to me for years. And I've kind of named it here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I know who you are now.
Mm-hmm.
You're that thought.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we don't have to be enemies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you know what? You're always going to be my neighbor.
Yeah.
And I know you're not moving
mm-hmm.
away that I'll never see you again. So we're going to live. We're going to learn to live together.
Yeah. Yeah.
So come on in. Make yourself at home. I got a spare bedroom if you even want to stay for a while. But I can't really spend any time with you right now. I hope
yeah.
you understand.
Yeah.
And JJ, I can't explain it. It took away its power
mm-hmm.
because I didn't fight it. And I didn't mm-hmm. say, oh, here we go. What do I do with this? So after a while, and this didn't just happen one time, but every time, weeks, months, it just lost its ability to send me off into a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that that's going to work for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It might work for a few. That's what worked for me.
Yeah.
So I would ask you to address that whole concept of taking away the power mm-hmm. that this thing has over someone, panic attack or former trauma triggering. I would think that if you could not necessarily fight it, because you don't win very often, but to accept it, to embrace it, to bring it close, maybe that's the way you can control it. Yeah. Am I right in some aspect?
Absolutely. So there's a saying, the more you resist, the more it persists.
Oh, I like that.
Right? Mm-hmm. So the way to deal with this very challenging situation is to accept it. And there's a therapy method. So when we do practice, right, we don't just do one thing. We learn a lot, and then you take bits and pieces. Of course, I'm like me, I'm like grounded in narrative therapy and also in EMDR, but I also take something else, such as there's a therapy called ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. Hmm. That's exactly that. You accept, and it's very good for anxiety. So you accept the anxiety part of you. And that's another therapy called parts work. What you're describing is that there are always different parts of us. You can look at the panic attack as a part of you, but it's not the entire you. As you described to me, there's clearly two parts, right? One part is the part is just like, you take a seat over there. I know that you're the anxious one. I want you to take a seat. I got more important things to do, right? So there's parts work. Number one, it's distinguish the parts. That also means I am not anxiety. My whole being is not panic attack. It's only a part of me. So that's one thing we want to establish for clients when I work with clients with OCD, I was like, the first thing we do, you are not OCD. There's a part of you that has OCD. You can have a dialogue with the OCD part, but you don't have to buy into it, right? So that's number one. Establish the facts that you are not, it's not you. Anxiety is not you. It's just a part of you. So what? Number two, how do you interact with that? That's the second piece. You don't want to push it away, because the more you work around it, the more is there. You embrace it, acceptance, right? You accept it. The more you accept it, you learn to work with each other. So I have a client say, OCD, I'm too busy right now. Can I get back to you after I got this done?
I love it.
Right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how you learn to work with each other, knowing this thing is there. It's much easier to work with yourself that way versus I'm trying to avoid you. I'm trying to work around you. It's almost like you're trying to cut off a part of you. And that's what we say in our language is dissociation. I'm trying to cut off a part of me. Trying to dissociate. When you try to dissociate, that part never goes away. Like you said, it's like the way I kind of envision it, I talk to my clients, it's like a rock in your shoes. You learn to walk with the rock in your shoes. That's by trying to like, I'm not going to deal with it. That's what it is. In time, your foot will be crooked. Mm-hmm. And then you say, oh, I'm walking, but not very comfortably, but I'm walking. The only way to deal with it is stare it in the face and go in it and take it out.
You've mentioned a number of times, and I know this is one of your specialties, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yes.
I never had that. That was never part of my story. I know I talked about the genetic component in my family. There is someone who I know very well who has suffered from this to the point where it could take over an hour just to shave.
Right.
And the explanation that I would get is, well, I would shave, but if I accidentally cut myself slightly or I forgot that I didn't start on my left side, I'd have to start all over again. Get the foam. But then what would happen once I got that, then I would have to knock on the mirror two times. Mm-hmm. and then shave, and then turn on the water three times, off and on. Now, I can't relate to that. Mm-hmm. I cannot. This is where I'm the person who says, well, just don't do that, which I know is dumb because that's somebody telling me, well, just don't have a panic attack.
Yeah.
What is OCD from a clinical standpoint? What is the person, this is the way that they control their little world, that if I do these little rituals, I'm empowered. What is happening here?
Their limbic system is overactive. So everything is danger to them. It's all about fear. Fear, all about fears and anxiety of not doing it right. Or if I don't do it certain things a certain way, something bad would happen. So it's purely fear-based, purely survival. All limbic system has a strong genetic components to it. And there's different categories. So just high level as defined OCD. Obsession is refers to mental activity. More like if I walk out there, I hear something. For example, I hear a loud bang and I know there's construction going on, right? Construction site, there's going to be a lot of noise. But instead of, I know this is a construction site, instead of refer that to a construction noise, they thought there's a gunshot. And so they start running. Although they know this part still take charge and start running in fear. And that's obsession. It has a lot more to do with thought. Compulsion is all behavior, such as the more typical people think about washing hands, keep washing hands. And like you said, knock three times. Some people have to flush toilet, you know, three times. It has to be in an order of three. It cannot be one or two. It cannot be four. It has to be three. So, and it needs to be in certain succession. It cannot have like the gap to be too long or too short. Those are compulsion. And compulsion is actually what people did to bring down their anxiety. So the initial trigger is obsession. Obsession, I keep thinking, oh my God, it's going to get worse. Oh my God, this person coming after me, right? And compulsion is actually your physiological responses to bring down the anxiety to begin with. But the solution becomes a problem itself because you can't stop washing hands. So typically we'll see people with OCD, some people with mostly obsession-based. They just have a lot of thought, but not a whole lot of washing hands or has to walk certain square or... Mm-hmm. You know, flushing toilets. Mm-hmm. Some people have mostly obsession. Some people have mostly compulsion, such as they have to keep go back and check the door, check the stove, check. Checking is by far the most common OCD.
Oh, is that right?
Checking.
Would that, I guess some people would even get halfway down the block in their car, they'd have to turn around and go check again, right?
Like keep checking is the most common one. And checking, those are compulsion. Some people have mostly compulsion. Some people have both. And we can like, based on diagnosis, there are like 12 different categories. Some people only own certain things and some people have like overall. It's like some of my clients only driving. Driving is their main problem, and they always feel like they're hitting somebody. So I have to go back and check. Did I hit somebody? Go back and check. It's very distressful.
Yeah, I would, I can't. Well, the person that I had described before, it's been years since they were able to finish a book.
Yeah.
And again, this doesn't make sense to me, but it does to them, where they would start a book. And if they accidentally went two pages in and like, oh, I skipped it, they'd have to go all the way back and start the book over again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or if they misread a line,
yeah,
like, oh, I lost my place.
Yeah.
Oh, I got to start over again. And the way that this person explained to me in their counseling, it was more that that was a scary thing when if they had lost control. They right. had made a mistake.
Fear.
And
yeah.
they needed a controlled, orderly world.
Yeah.
And so if you knock a few times here or you yeah. flush or you mess something in the
yeah,
book, you go to
down.
The beginning.
Yeah.
Right. It is it's kind of a, I need order in mm-hmm. my world
Absolutely.
Because it's a scary world.
Extreme order. Yes. Yeah.
Man, oh man. What I really want to do here in the time that we have remaining once again is to really help folks who have suffered from this. And I get the impression, JJ, that this has become here. Let me put it this way. Here in America, in the land of the free
mm-hmm.
and the wealth and the richness and the liberties that we have, anxiety, depression, all of these disorders, if you will, keep going up.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that a lot of that is COVID-related. But I'm even going before COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And the trend lines have been going up for years.
Mm-hmm.
We get through COVID, okay, we're on the other side of it,
mm-hmm.
and it's still going up. And I sit there and I go, why? We have so much in this country. And I guess that really has nothing to do with it. Do you have any theory or philosophy that, take COVID out of it, why more Americans suffer from these ailments than they might have 50 or 100 years ago? Or did they suffer more, but they just didn't talk about it? What is your professional opinion on that?
This is my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I wanna be straight. I think it just increased awareness and increased diagnosis, increasing in our willingness to talk about it. I actually think this thing has been around for a while. We just don't talk about it, or it's too shameful to admit that. And now it's a different society. We are all more transparent. It's almost like a trend now. I'm a movie star. I'm in counseling.
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
it
well,
means
yeah,
something,
good point.
Right? Yeah. So I think that makes talking about it more acceptable. And I do think it is a healthy trend, because the more we share it, the more we see we are all human. I mean, we all have something. We all have some. Nobody's immune to any of these.
And I would say we've got to stop the stigma on some of this
right.
because as I have told people, as I drove in today to do this podcast, it's weird when people know that I used to be on television, was a TV news reporter and anchor, and they go, you have anxiety? You have panic attack, but you're talking to 100,000 people. I'm like, I can't explain it.
Uh-huh.
I've given public investment seminars.
Uh-huh.
That's never been an issue because I that's not part of the fear that I have.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really explain that part of it. But one of the reasons why I've waited so long to go this public is I fought the stigma of weakness.
Right. Exactly.
And I hated that. And I thought, you know, I can't tell this person that I have these panic attacks because they won't like me.
Mm-hmm.
They'll think I'm weak.
Yeah.
In my own profession
yeah.
as a financial advisor for 30 years,
yeah.
I frankly don't care anymore. I just don't. You get to, again, it's age and experience. We're like, uh-huh. whatever.
Yeah.
But back in the day when I started my business, when I was in my early 30s, there was no way that I would tell especially newer clients coming in, because in my mind, ooh, I don't want some guy that's got a panic attack disorder.
Mm-hmm.
He's weak.
Mm-hmm.
And what is he going to do with my money? That used to drive me crazy.
Right, right.
But it has nothing to do with that. And I would just urge people to maybe, if you don't have any of these issues, count yourself blessed. But we all have issues to some degree or another. But to listen,
mm-hmm.
be there for people,
mm-hmm.
don't stigmatize because, and I want you to address this, it ain't weakness, is it? Has nothing to do with that.
I actually think people that seek out counseling show more strength.
Yeah.
Because they're willing to take on kind of their internal challenges. It's actually show more strength than I'm just trying to avoid it. I mean, really.
Yep.
I actually think people show up stronger because they're willing to tackle it.
That's what I'm going with, because that's what I told myself, that as I share the story, Dave, that's not cowardly.
No.
I'm not saying it's cowardly not to share it, but my point is to put it out there mm-hmm. and let some others judge you in a negative mm-hmm. way. Like I said, I don't care, not my issue.
Yeah.
And that's when you know you've kind of made it to certain degrees, when you say, not my problem.
Yeah.
I can't help. If you're judging me a certain way, that's on you. You know, I'd be your friend, but if mm-hmm. that's not what you want, so be
yeah.
it. So,
yeah.
JJ Meyer of Insight Counseling. Where? Well, yes, please do. Go right ahead.
Sorry, we are rebranding our Insight Counseling. So our website is actually not up and running yet.
Oh, okay.
So I have my personal website is Quest Counseling. It's STL Quest Counseling. So
we'll put that up on the screen too, so people can see that.
Great.
I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah.
Well, do I send the check for today's therapy directly to you? Do I get the invoice?
You can come over anytime you feel like it.
Well, this was wonderful. I love talking about this kind of stuff because I've lived it so personally, and my goal, and I know yours is too, that somebody out there has been
yes.
hearing us have this conversation, and all of a sudden they feel joyous. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't have to live this alone. I am now going to seek proper counseling. So, JJ, thank you so much for spending
time
with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right, we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening, and please forward the link to this podcast to friends, family, neighbors, even strangers. They'll thank you later. If you'd like more information on our wealth management team, just go to your search engine and type in Simons and Cordes, S-I-M-O-N-S and C-O-R-D-E-S, Simons and Cordes, and the website will be the first thing that pops up. I'll talk to you again soon on the next episode of the Simon Says podcast.